Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The World Wide Web turned 25 last week, but with technology, it's always about the next big thing. Last week, in a nod to the World Wide Web's birthday, experts were asked to predict how the internet will affect life and society in 2025, just around the corner, for good and bad. Joining us to discuss the new report is the director of the Pew Research Center Internet Project, Lee Rainey. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Hi, Ann. Great to be with you.
A main theme is this sense of seamlessness that will characterize our relationship with the internet. Talk about that for a minute. What do we mean by that?
Yes, the answers splayed out in a variety of directions with a variety of predictions, but all of them sort of started with the thought that in the next 10 years, maybe 15 years, the internet will become like electricity in people's lives. In other words, it will become even more important than it currently is to the rhythms of their life, to their functioning in their life, but it won't be nearly as visible. You'll wear the internet, you'll drive in the internet, you'll enter rooms and other parts of the environment that are connected parts of the environment. It will be ubiquitous. But you won't necessarily think as you enter those rooms or sit in those cars, I'm on the internet now. That's how potent it's going to be in people's lives and how pervasive it's going to be in their lives.
When I talk to people who are reviewing Google Glass and that kind of a thing, they say there's still this issue of you look weird when you walk in the room. The internet in that way, that wearable way, won't be weird by 2025.
Yeah, in a variety of directions. First of all, we're in the new era we're entering of wearable internet devices, not only Google Glass, but watches and other pieces of jewelry, for instance. It's pretty primitive. You know, we're still trying to figure out what's the right look for these devices, what's the cool design functionality we can give them and things like that. That will get better over time. So it'll be more stylish and it'll fit into people's sense of identity in the way that style things do. The other thing is that, of course, as computing power gets ever better, as the cloud gets ever bigger that we feed our data into, that these will be things that don't necessarily have to be bulky or big or designed in different ways from other pieces of jewelry and clothing and things like that. So we'll walk around with the internet and we will announce to the world, or the world will pick up from us whether we announce it or not, we're here and we've got things to do and say and data to be gathered up, and we're going to be profiled in a lot more robust ways because of all of this data that we are shedding from ourselves as we march through life.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Lee Rainey. He's director of the Pew Research Center Internet Project. We're talking about the future of the internet and how it will become a part of our lives in the future, in this case, 2025. There were 15 main themes that the report identified, Lee. 8 were positive. Now, it's only a small majority, if you want to look at it that way, but the experts you surveyed were optimistic by and large.
Yeah, a lot of them actually see progress being made in a way that people will say, gosh, this is an improvement in my life. And the same people were saying, yeah, but there will be a price to pay for that. So in some respects, these themes were overlapping and intertwined. So the positive themes were things will get more convenient. You know, we will just be better understood by the environment around us. The environment around us will feed us interesting information and data so that we can navigate a little bit more conveniently. Our devices and appliances will be more helpful to us. Education will get disrupted. You know, one of the big themes that a lot of these experts thought was positive was the change in the internet has swept through many other industries, newspapers, the record business, the radio business has its share of disruption. Education has been pretty impermeable so far to these changes, but these experts are now seeing a variety of trends that suggest that particularly higher education, but even K-12 eventually is going to get turned on its head by a lot of the technology change that's on the horizon.
You mentioned earlier, we'll be wherever we go, they'll be reading us, the ubiquitous they, will be gathering data from us. A lot of loss of privacy is another main theme, but some say that privacy will be reserved only for the elite. Why is that?
Well, there are market opportunities as you see the level of concern among some people about loss of privacy. You know, it's a very important American value. And so there are companies now thinking, well, if we're living in a society that there's a lot more surveillance going on and there's a lot more capture of data as people march through life, maybe there are ways to, for a price, to help people cover their tracks or to help people be anonymous when they don't necessarily want to be seen, to help them shade their past in a way that makes them look a little bit better than they might otherwise look, basically to clean up their past and to make sure that they are understood in the way they want to be understood. But you'll pay a price for that, and so some people will be able to afford that level of cleanup and of reputation monitoring, and other people who don't have the resources probably won't have the same opportunities to shape the world's understanding of who they are. That's what folks are talking about when they were mentioning this in their survey answers.
Let's go back to the technology. It's described in the report a global, immersive, invisible, ambient, networked computing environment built through the continued proliferation of smart sensors, cameras, software, databases, and massive data centers in a world-spanning information fabric known as the Internet of Things.
About 3 years ago, we passed a major milestone as a planetary society. There became more connected devices than there were connected humans. In other words, there were sensors in the ground, there were sensors in consumer goods, there were sensors in the ocean, there were other devices that were talking to each other, and there were more machines connected to each other than there were humans connected to each other through the internet or cell phones or things like that. The gap between connected devices and connected humans is going to grow ever more because there are many more things that can get internet addresses and can feed information to other machines. And that's part of what folks are talking about with the Internet of Things. They're also talking about the trend towards wearable internet devices, as we were saying before. Mm-hmm. You'll have the internet in your jewelry and in your car and in your rooms, and all of that material will be capturing information and talking to other machines that have profiled you or have algorithms to try to understand who you are and what you want and things like that. So this notion that artifacts and pieces of the material world are connected is a big part of what people are saying when they use the phrase Internet of Things.
What role will governments and corporations have in the digital life in the future? I know the Department of Commerce is getting ready or did just hand off control or oversight of the Internet. Seems like they're getting out of the business.
Well, there are two ways to talk about that. For these experts, one of the things that the themes they struck was that as people find each other more readily, through their interests, that it doesn't have to be where you live, it doesn't have to be what your ethnic background is, it doesn't have to be connected to the schools you went to or the jobs you have. You'll just be able to find people around the world who share your interests and share your passions or share your hobbies or whatever. And so the global relationships will grow, according to these experts. It'll be easier for Americans to talk to anybody anywhere else if they so choose. So that's part of it, and it's harder for government to make rules in an environment where people don't necessarily think of themselves as functioning as residents of Columbus. They are functioning as fans of a British soccer team with other fans around the world. And it's hard for governments to sort of make rules in that environment. But the other thing that is embedded in lots of their answers is that these tensions that we're talking about between convenience and privacy and what kinds of information gets captured and used, that's a huge role for government. And lots of societies are struggling to try to apply pre-internet information laws to post-internet information environments. And so there's this other sense that there's going to be a lot of government activity around how information gets treated and how people are understood in this new environment. And we haven't nearly yet wrestled to the ground all of the huge issues that are part of this new environment.
Some of the negative themes focus on abuse and violence, cyberbullying, cyberterrorism, and that sort of thing. I mean, ultimately, we're talking about human nature, and that's not really going to change. Is the ability to track people down who abuse the system going to change?
Yes. There's kind of an arms race between people who want to make mischief or make misery for other folks. They are able to use these tools the exact same way that benevolent and well-meaning people use these tools. One of the really memorable phrases in one of the answers to the survey was, bad stuff scales. just like the good stuff is scaling, mean that it can get out to lots more people in lots more ways now with these new technology tools. And so there's a sort of arms race dynamic that sets in as bad guys figure out ways that they can steal people's money or make them miserable or promote horrible causes. And governments and law enforcement folks and now militaries are struggling to keep up with the threats that those pose. And it speaks to this large issue that we started the conversation with. The Internet's more and more important to more and more people and more organizations. So the threat that any disruption or bad people can cause to it is exponentially greater as the Internet becomes more embedded in people's lives.
It's sort of like what happens when, you know, we have these big brownouts or what happens if something goes wrong with the grid. People are like, well, why can't they fix it? What's the deal? Because we are so in it's such a part of our life, as you said, to have, you know, to be able to flip the switch and have electricity. And one negative theme suggests that people aren't noticing the changes that technology is already having on society, that the Internet technology is already having. And why is that a negative? Should people try to be aware of how these changes are taking place?
Awareness is always better than lack of awareness in sort of all walks of life, these experts are saying. And one of the, you know, the simple ways that the current environment is different, even from like 10 years ago, is all these smartphones that people have that not only allow them to make phone calls wherever they are, whenever they feel like it, if they're not dependent on getting access to a wired telephone that's in a physical place, but it's also handed people tremendous computing power in their pocket, and so they can access any information they want. They can contribute any information that they want. Lots of people post to Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms from their smartphones, and it's second nature now to lots of people. Probably it was never first nature. You know, they never thought, oh, gosh, this is a big change in the human condition, that we can do all this sharing and all this knowledge and information creation on the fly. But that's what these experts are talking about. Awareness of how life has changed, social structures have changed, how governments are challenged. Being aware of that now will have a payoff, their argument is, because you would hope that governments and other regulators and just smart people will come up with better solutions for the future than some of the ones that are catastrophic.
Some of the experts predicted that automation and other innovations associated with the Internet will cause great job loss, and that is one of the great challenges going forward, is how to employ people.
Right, and we have a separate question, and we'll be issuing another report later this year on that very pointed and direct subject. But the broad answer in these open-ended predictions that the experts made was, we know what's being disrupted now, and we know the kinds of jobs that have already been lost and the kinds of jobs that are at risk. You know, now it's some very important upper-middle-class, white-collar jobs that are in the line of fire. You know, some major medical materials that medical specialists now perform might be performed by lesser-paid people in other parts of the world, or maybe done by machines in the future. And so that's something that everybody can see now and is worried about now. And what isn't nearly as clear is what kinds of jobs will replace those, what kind of training people will need, what kind of value added the human mind can add to the machine capabilities and things like this. So people are worried about it. And yet, you know, if you look at history, there have been huge technological disruptions over time. And the human species has found new clever ways to take advantage of it and to build new wealth and new economics around it. And so there's some who are pretty hopeful about the future, too.
Last week, in a nod to the World Wide Web's 25th birthday, experts were asked to predict how the Internet will affect life and society in 2025. That's what Lee Rainey of the Pew Research Center Internet Project and I have been talking about. If you want to read that for yourself, you can go to pewresearch.org or check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Lee Rainey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Ann.
Lee Rainey is the director of the Pew Research Center Internet Project. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. March Madness kicks off today, and by now many, in fact millions, of college basketball fans and maybe people who couldn't care less about college basketball have filled in their brackets. Most go with their gut or choose by team mascots or some other sentimental way, but there is a more scientific way to approach bracketology. And with Warren Buffett offering up $1 billion for the perfect bracket, there's good reason to get it right. Joining us now to discuss how to use math to make smarter bracket picks is Tim Chartier. He's associate professor in the Department of Mathematics and Computer Science at Davidson College in North Carolina. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Tim's book, Math Bites, Google Bombs, Chocolate-Covered Pie, and Other Cool Bits in Computing, which has a chapter on March Madness, is set to come out in just a few weeks. Tim, first of all, there's never been a perfect bracket prediction, right?
No, there hasn't. It's very, very difficult to do. There's a lot of randomness in sport that you're trying to overcome, even though there's just 63 games.
You and your students started working on the bracket problem in 2009. What got you started working on this problem in the first place?
It was literally math research. Is that my research is with Amy Langville at the College of Charleston, and we work in ranking methods. So we might look at ranking such as Google does when you put in a query into search engines. And then I'm working with a company called Twizoo, where we're trying to rank restaurants in London based on tweets that come through the internet. And then on this one, we were working on sports ranking methods and trying to see if we could be more predictive in a setting where going in with a lot of momentum could be quite important, which is what we decided could be important in March Madness.
Without getting too bogged down in jargon, a.k.a. math, how does the program work?
Well, there's a couple ways to talk about it. Intriguingly, it's just linear algebra, which people learn in middle school. And some people might try to repress those days, but what it was it's just like x plus y equals 5 and x minus 2y equals 6. And the only reason it's relevant there is that the unknowns, the x and y that we're using, are those ratings for the teams. I don't know how to rate them, but the reason we do it as a linear system is that my rating depends on the rating of the teams I play. And so that's the way that we build a system that finds, first of all, strength of schedule. So the first thing we're trying to do, and people can do that themselves, it depends how much knowledge you have of sports. And one of the nice things is for us, the math does it for us. So we just make some math decisions, which we can talk about. But some of them aren't that complicated. To do the research to produce it was a bit more complicated. But in the end, I had my 11-year-old son and my 7-year-old daughter working on their brackets, because there's $1 billion this year, so every edge you can get.
The description when I was reading about this and reading your chapter in the book, it made me think of Rollerball, that story about how they stacked a team with all the right players to make the equation work both sides.
Yeah, one of the intriguing things is right now in the media, you'll often hear that the odds of a perfect bracket are 1 in 9 quintillion. And in a sense, that's true, but that's really if you were trying to pick it flipping a coin.
Okay.
And, that's most of us really aren't going to choose that method. that just seems kind of fruitless. And some of the outcomes, particularly in the first round, you pretty much kind of know what's going to happen. But then after that, it does become much harder. So what we're trying to do is reduce the odds and reduce that, sometimes we call it a search space, of feasible brackets. So let's say that you, rather than 50% likely on each game, you could get to 70% likely. So you went from 9 quintillion, which isn't even a number we typically use. That's 9 with 18 zeros after it. So it's just, 9, I'm never going to figure that out, number of brackets. But when you get to 70% likely, you go down to 5, it's a little bit larger, but it's 5 billion brackets. But then if you set 1%, you down to...
Tim, we're losing you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's good.
If you go, is that better?
That's better.
Okay. If you go from 70%, you get down to 5 billion. And if you get down to, if you go up to 71% accuracy, you go all the way down to 2 billion. And so each little percentile that we can kind of pull out with the math makes it much more probable. It's still very hard, but nonetheless, that's you're really helping yourself in the long run.
Okay, I've been corrected. It's not Rollerball, it's Moneyball. Me bad. Okay, so the software uses either a Colli ranking, which uses only wins and losses, or a Massey ranking, which uses the scores of the games. Can you elaborate on the reasons for each?
Sure. The reason for wins and losses only is that sometimes scores, there's a lot of, if you will, noise in scores. Is like my parents are season ticket holders for the Davidson Wildcats, our men's and women's team. And sometimes they'll talk about, you know, well, the women, they won by 15, but actually it was kind of close because they were only up by 5 in the last minute, and then fouling happened. And so sometimes you can the score is not indicative of really how the game was played out. And so sometimes you get a truer measure of all of that if you just go wins, losses, and that's the Colli method. The Massey method says, I am going to look at scores, and it does the best, if you will, fit of it. And I'll give you a website where people can play with these ideas for free. But the Massey method, the neat thing about that one is when it pops out the rating, which is just a math number, if your rating was 15 and my rating was 10, then I take the difference in those, which would be 5, and that's telling you the expected win. So you would be expected to beat me by 5. So it's actually giving you. So when you look for this year, a lot of the times when people pop out results, they're very close. So sometimes you might, it's so close with these methods, you might want to then say, you know, I really like the Wildcat. Well, we're not in the tournament, but, you know, I really like blue. You know what I mean? At that point, you might be, I mean, that's part of the reason I have my 11-year-old son is a lot of it so that he and I have some nice time together and can just enjoy making a bracket. But it's also my element of randomness I'm trying to induce. And my daughter's picking it by how funny she thinks it is to say the school name. So so Baylor, which is the way she says that's doing pretty well in her bracket.
Can you, now all of this aside, your students and what you've been working on with them in this bracket problem, they've turned out some amazingly accurate results.
Yeah. Yeah, last year, a Davidson cheerleader and math major, she's a math major, was in a math course with me. She beat 96% of over 8 million brackets submitted to ESPN. So she won the Ben & Jerry's in town, actually offers 3 free cone coupons, ice cream cone coupons for whoever wins. And so that's actually the biggest thing in my class, bigger than even grades. It's like, who gets the ice cream? So every year I don't bring up that I'm doing that until I confirm that Ben & Jerry's is doing that, because then I would have horrible teaching evaluations because of the promise. I guess I just buy it, but then that's not really that right either. So, but yeah. And then in previous years, in 2009, the first time we did it, simply to see if we were getting predictive information, we had one that beat 97% of 4 million that year. And that was completely surprising because literally we're just doing math research. And I know for a lot of people, creating new math can even seem like that's kind of hard to even know what that means. But when you're doing applied math, you're wondering, is it even going to work?
Uh-huh.
And so to get 97% on the first shot was stunning. I mean, we were so surprised. And then the next year, I introduced it into my classes, so people learned it in 1 week. And then a student was in the 99.9 percentile out of 5 million brackets that year.
Now, you do workshops on this with just people who can pay to go to these things?
Yeah. Yeah, well, often I last week I did a fundraiser for the new Museum of Mathematics in Manhattan, where we actually gave out our innermost codes that we have so that people could play with it. And the main reason for that was it took a lot of work to get it ready for that type of event. But it was also because it's the Museum of Math. It's a wonderful interactive museum in Manhattan, or you can ride a tricycle with square wheels, but you have a smooth ride because it's not a flat road, and you can play with a fractal generator, so you stand in it and it actually makes you into a tree in similar ways that you use in computer graphics and movies. And so it's I'm a chair of the advisory council, and so it was a delight to be there and also to go with my students and actually help people learn to use this. But there is a public site where you can play with the software in the way that what we did in 2009, all of that is in there. And that's March. I can send you the link for your webpage, but it's March Mathness, not Madness. Mathness.davidson.edu.
Okay. Well, March Mathness.davidson.edu. We'll put it on our website at wosu.org. Is there any way to spot an upset?
Yes. And one of the things we're doing in there is you're asked to. You're asked for how much you're going to weight a game. And so what that means is that you're trying to figure out, okay, well, let's say that we will break the season into three parts. And so the first third of the season, you can say, well, how much of a game are you going to let that count as? And let's say that we think that's less predictive of how someone's going to play in the tournament. So you'll count it as half a game. So that means that you would get half a win, and I would get, for instance, half a loss. And then in the middle third, maybe we think that's a full game. So then that would be a full win and a full loss. But then in the last third, you could say, well, wait a minute. I'm going to make that 1.5 because I think it's even more predictive of how people will play. And by varying those numbers, you actually are able to find teams that are hot. But as I said earlier, a real key to this is strength of schedule. So it's not just are you hot, it's actually are you hot against hard teams. And if you're both of those, then your ranking goes way up. And so we can find teams that might be seeded much higher or much lower than what our ranking says. And so the first year I did it, actually, in 2010, I was actually in an interview when all of a sudden my email feed just went crazy, and my students had all picked up what was that year the first upset of the tournament. And what was neat was that my bracket was the baseline method without that additional new information that, that you know, what makes you hot. Everything counted as one game, and I did not pick it up. And so every year in class, I always put in the baseline, partially because I almost always lose when I do that, and I'm not a particularly competitive person, and so it's really fun to have the students beat me. But if anyone's out there who teaches, you need to be okay with that, because Davidson, we have a wonderful relationship with students, so they feel quite free to come in and talk smack and tease me about it, and so which is perfectly fine. If they're one of the real neat things about it too, is that as you see what you don't pick up, you often think about, well, wait a minute, what did I do? Mm-hmm. And then you begin to think, oh, wait, I didn't measure for this. And that type of thinking is exactly what people want to have. That's very valuable mathematical thinking, where sometimes when people go, when will I ever use this? That's when you're going to use math in ways that allow you to look at the world in very mathematical and useful ways as well.
Now, when you wrote about the recency effect, I, of course, thought of Michigan State University, my alma mater, which has been just murdered this season because of injuries. But everybody got together at the for the last game and or the last couple games, and they did very, very well.
Yes. One of the things, in a team like that, we'd really actually want to downweight quite a bit of their games, except for the ones that are more indicative of how they play. But it's very likely that the brackets that use the research that's on that website will not be as accurate for Michigan State because of just how few games it is at the end. So you'd have to be wary of. So your allegiance to Michigan State might actually help you, because you might decide, I'm not going to go with the math, and so that might help you there.
No, you definitely have to know about the recency effect, what it's recently done, and rank and weight those much heavier.
Yes, exactly.
What ranking ideas have you tried out in the system that haven't worked out well? Didn't you talk about mascots?
Yeah, I am. So I tried one where I did just flip a coin, and I thought it would vary a lot. But again, there's 9 quintillions, so you got to, I only flipped it 5. I didn't actually flip it. I wrote a computer program that flipped it. But It was interesting. 98% of, if I submitted my bracket to last year's tournament, 98% of the brackets actually beat my coin flipped one, which kind of surprised me. I thought one of them would be in the 50 percentile or something, but I wasn't able to pick that information up. But the one that surprised me more was when I went with the seeds. I went strictly with the seeds until I got to the final four, because then they're all number one seeds. And then I went with their winning percentage. And that was only around 50%. I forget the exact number, but it was right around 50%. And that really surprised me as well. I didn't think it would be that low. And it wouldn't be, depending on the year. I just picked last year because I had all of the data from ESPN. So no matter what score you got, I knew what percentile you were in. And so that was interesting to me.
So by any chance, did you look at Ohio State's chances?
No, but if you go to my site, you can put in your parameters. You can just even go with the strict method. You can, when it says uniform, that means that you're not doing any extra math that you have to do, and you can look for them and see where they are, and see, you know, where they are in the whole rankings. One thing we're doing is we're actually keeping track of what people are trying, so that we can then do research on kind of the crowdsourcing information. Like, if we combine what everyone's thinking, could we create a good bracket? And that's like 2009. I have absolutely no idea, but it would be fun to look at.
So what do you think are the chances? Is anybody going to make $1 billion this year or not?
Well, Warren Buffett's, he has a billion, multi-billionaire, because he's pretty smart about his money. And they've done a lot of research. The expected number of first round perfect brackets is usually between around 0 and maybe 1,000. And then when we get to the second round, well, we can live with hope. And so that's a good thing to do. And it's, you know, we can live the dream. So
wow.
It'll be fun.
Just 1,000 in just the first round.
Yeah, often. Last year there were 8 million submitted to ESPN, and nobody was perfect after the first round. Everyone made mistakes. And so it's very, very hard, depending on the year. But right now, our research says that this year could have a lot of upsets, because there's so much parity in the teams. It's pretty tough.
And that makes it interesting, of course. Tim Chartier, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about
it. You're
welcome. Tim Chartier, he's an associate professor in Department of Mathematics and Computer Science at Davidson College in North Carolina. We will post that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As smartphones become more and more common, not only are we always connected, we also have a camera at our fingertips. For smartphone designers, competing for the best camera, getting the best quality might not be up to the lens or the number of megapixels, but it may depend on software. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com, and also time to buy a new pair of snow boots. You're down there in, is it Virginia?
I'm in Maryland. Yeah.
Maryland, that's right.
I'm in Maryland. It was 60 degrees here in Maryland on Saturday, and then Monday morning I woke up and we had 8 inches of snow.
I had no idea. I guess I missed the news on that one. So sorry, Russell. We're snowless here in Columbus for a change. But you'll have to send us a picture.
I will do that.
On your new, was it Nokia? I always mispronounce Nokia and Nokia.
Oh, so the Nokia Lumia. So this is kind of cool, and this is something that over the last year we've really seen smartphone manufacturers show off their unique software when it comes to taking pictures. And this in particular is something that I think we will see from more than one company over this coming year. Nokia has an app that they originally released on their gigantic Windows phone called the 1520 that allowed you to take a photo and actually adjust the focus point in the picture afterwards. And it was through an app that they called Refocus. And that is now available for all Nokia Lumia Windows phones that have what they call their Windows Phone Black, the name of the update that hit those phones over the last couple of months. It's almost every Nokia Windows Phone, and it's really, really simple to take pictures of. And I've found over the last couple of days, just silly things that I would take pictures of just because it's so much fun to go in and adjust the focus point for a lot of these pictures.
How does it work?
Well, so it's on your phone.
Yeah.
You hold the phone still for, maybe 2 or 3 seconds. And instead of taking one photo, what it's actually doing is taking six. But it's taking six at different focal points, each one maybe, 4 or 5 feet back. And then it takes them and stitches them together in this application so that maybe you've got a picture of your child in the foreground. And then you tap the street sign that's way in the background, that's all blurry, and that street sign immediately becomes, just as crisp as the foreground was just a second ago, and then the child in the foreground becomes blurry instead.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is this really interesting concept that isn't new. There is a dedicated camera that was taking very similar kind of photos for a couple of years now, but they're really expensive. They're called Lytro cameras.
Yeah.
And they're array cameras, but they're like $300 just to take this one kind of photo. And because the technology for the Lytro camera at the time was really expensive, the sensor in it wasn't particularly high quality.
Huh.
The cool thing about Nokia's app is that, they've made some tremendous increases in smartphone camera quality over the last year, so that these apps are now capturing really huge photos that can then be refocused at will. And then you can take them and upload them to Nokia's website so that, as long as you've got a web browser, you can see these photos and interact with them.
Yeah, you wrote that the photos taken with refocus can only be shared through that special web. It's an embed service?
It's an embedded service, or you can just link to the website. If you go and try and share just the picture, then you'll get whatever is in the foreground focus. Like if you try and share it on Facebook or something like that,
it won't.
But you can share links to it, and then they'll be able to interact with it on their website.
Are other companies working on similar software?
There are definitely other companies working on similar software. HTC is announcing a new phone next week called the HTC One, and it is expected that they are going to have very similar tools available.
And the app, is it available for any phone?
Any Windows phone that is made by Nokia.
Okay.
So it's kind of a limited group now. But really what Nokia has done is kind of set this bar where, any app developer who has, this kind of camera knowledge, because there are a lot of third-party camera apps, it really wouldn't surprise me to see standalone apps that are maybe $5 and $6 come out for Android phones or for the iPhone later on this year. Because what really ends up happening here is, the ability to take those photos and then the software to stitch them together and allow people to interact with them. And now that that's happened in an application and not a dedicated piece of hardware, I think it'll become really common by the end of the year.
Amazon has raised the price of Prime from $79 to $99. You're saying, well, first of all, why are they raising it $20? But you're saying it's well worth it.
Oh, it's so worth it. That's me. It's my shopping habits make it so that it's totally worth it.
But if you're already into Prime at $79, you're saying people will still be into it at $99.
I think that they should definitely still be into it at $99 if they enjoy it at $79. It's important to understand that Amazon has had the $79 service available since 2005. They've not increased the price since 2005. And since then, gas has become more expensive, shipping costs have become more expensive, and the Amazon Prime service has expanded to cover a truly exceptional amount of products.
Tell us just what Prime does again.
Well, so Amazon has the Prime service available so that you can get a huge swath of products on their website for, you can get the next day shipping on it for free, as opposed to paying whatever the next day shipping would be, or you can get same day shipping for $4, where it'll ship out that day and it'll show up, within a 24-hour period, it'll show up. And in some markets, they've even started doing you know, within 12 hours. So you've ordered it in the morning. It actually shows up by the afternoon in a couple of different markets. But the Prime service started off as kind of like a small group of products. And now there are so many products that are Prime capable on Amazon's website that you could effectively shop and only purchase things that are Amazon Prime supported and have them all arrive the next day. It is really perfect for impulse buyers like me that see something and go, man, I can have this tomorrow. Let's go ahead and spend that money, which may not be a good thing, but that's the kind of shopper I am.
But the savings on just shipping just over the course of a year, if you spread it out.
Especially, yeah. Over the course of the year, it ends up being really cost effective, especially if you shop during Christmas time, like I do. Hmm. I've ordered some really kind of crazy things from Amazon because the Prime shipping was available. I had a queen size mattress that I ordered from Amazon because my furniture guy down the street couldn't deliver it until the next week. And so kind of as a joke, I looked up on Amazon to see if it was there, and it was the exact same mattress. And they delivered it the next day for $4.
Amazon does have competitors. You've mentioned specifically Google and Newegg. What are they like?
So Google is starting to put together similar competition for that same day delivery in a couple of areas, San Francisco and I think Seattle. Are two of the places where they're trying it out, where you can order things through Google's checkout service and they will have it delivered later that day. But Newegg has a similar service on their website. They're an electronics website where you can order computer parts and have them delivered within, you know, 2 days for very, very little. They're, you know, similar services, but not nearly as wide a product range as what Amazon is offering.
When are we going to get the drone delivery?
I don't think that the drone delivery was totally serious.
Oh, rats.
I think that Jeff Bezos decided that he just wanted to start that conversation, and it's a good thing that he did. When we do actually have that, and I think that is, you know, if it ever happens, it'll be several years down the road. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be interesting.
Okay, do they sell jetpacks then?
They do not sell jetpacks. And that is, you know, you're really hitting on some pain points that I personally disagree with. You know, we really should have jetpacks now.
So when does the price go into effect?
So it actually goes into effect at the end of this week, if I remember correctly. And if you have an Amazon Prime account that needs to be refreshed, where you need to you know, re-up your subscription, then you can still get it this week for the $79.
Okay. Moving on, Samsung. By the way, if anyone has a question for Russell Holley about anything, so far he's only missed a few in the course of about 2.5 or 3 years. Tech blogger for geek.com. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Samsung Galaxy Core Advanced smartphone accessories. You want to talk about it. Can you describe the new accessories?
It's such an exciting name, and what's interesting about that is that the phone itself is really not particularly exciting. It's really kind of a lackluster phone that I think a lot of people wouldn't be interested in buying for themselves, but there are a ton of accessories that Samsung is trying out for this phone that really make it exceptional for you know, people with disabilities who need, you know, kind of impairment assistant tools. And there are three that Samsung's calling life assistant tools that I think are really incredible. The first is this kind of it's almost radar that's built into a case that snaps into your phone, and they take this ultrasonic cover is what they call it. If there's anything immediately in front of you within like 2 meters, then the phone will actually vibrate a lot to let you know that there's something directly in front of you. So anybody with you know, with vision problems would be able to use this to kind of navigate a foreign area.
That is pretty cool.
It's definitely a neat idea, and they have some others. You know, they have the what they call the optical scan stand,
yeah,
which is really just it's really just kind of a tripod, really, but it's designed so that you can take a newspaper or a printed out piece of paper, and you can stick it at the bottom of the stand. And the phone goes in the top of the stand, and it will actually take a picture of the paper that you've put down there and then process the words that are on it and read it to you.
Read it. Okay. That's amazing. I mean, I think that stuff's amazing. Do you?
I definitely think that it's an incredible accomplishment to be able to do this and to have it work seamlessly enough that anybody would be able to set it up and work. The cool thing about the stand that reads the paper is that all you need to do is put the phone on the top of the stand, and the software in the phone will detect when a piece of paper is on the bottom of the stand, and then it'll do its work. And then you can just take it off whenever you're done and not have to worry about it killing the battery or anything.
And these technologies, this is very affordable for people who need them.
Yeah, I mean, so the whole point of the Galaxy Core Advanced phone was to be kind of a budget phone. And they haven't given a hard price for it yet. It was originally designed for kind of emerging markets where it would be a budget phone that was inexpensive. And the hardware in it is not particularly great when you compare it to like the Galaxy S5 or some of the other phones that Samsung makes. But combined with these accessories, you get a low-cost device that can really help people who would otherwise need another physical person there to help them. Hmm.
Julie, on campus at OSU. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Hi. I was at the St. Patrick's Day event yesterday in Betts Memorial. The lighting was dismal, but a man sitting next to me had a Samsung Note. And actually, he made a joke that it was the size of a shoe phone. And it kind of was like that smart shoe phone. It was a little biggish. But the images it took were extraordinary. And my relationship with my Apple phone, which I have a cracked screen and all that, is about up. And I was wondering, if I've always used Apple phones, am I going to have a really hard time switching to Samsung, particularly because I'm a computer idiot?
Okay. Thank you, Julie, for that honest question. Russell Holley.
It's definitely not as hard to switch as it used to be. Samsung, Android and iOS are really very similar now. Their user interfaces take a little getting used to, but a lot of the buttons are surprisingly in the same place. So I would say, you probably want to go to a store and poke at one for a couple minutes just to make absolutely sure. But especially with Samsung phones, I think the transition is a lot easier now for most people.
Okay, Julie, good luck. Mary and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have an iPad Air and wanted to use it as a video camera, but wanted to attach a shotgun mic to it and was looking for a recommendation of a compatible shotgun mic.
So there are a couple shotgun mics that are available for the iPad cases, but I don't know that I've ever used one in particular. I think the one that I've seen, I have a friend of mine who uses it a lot. It's actually a whole mount kit that he uses where it sits in and there's like a lighting clip that attaches on top. That may be a little more than what you're looking for. It's called Makayama, and you can find it just by searching for the iPad Air shotgun mic. And that's like a whole production studio thing that your iPad clips into. It's still portable, but I don't know that I've ever used just a shotgun for the iPad because the camera on the back has been traditionally not super great. But there's definitely a couple out there.
Okay.
Then they're usually relatively inexpensive. I'm sorry that I'm not more helpful there. I was trying to think if there was one brand in particular that stood out to me, but Makayama is the only one that I've ever used personally.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mary, for that call. Thanks to everybody for your call. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. I'll ask sooner next time. Russell Holley, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.